Chapter 5. Because at this time of day no Christian apologist dreams of denying the substantial truth of any of the more important allegations of Gibbon, Christians may complain of the suppression of some circumstances which might influence the general result, and they must remonstrate against the unfair construction of their case. But they no longer refuse to hear any reasonable evidence tending to show that persecution was less severe than had been once believed, and they have slowly learned that they can afford to concede the validity of all the secondary causes assigned by Gibbon, and even of others still more discreditable. The fact is, as the historian has again and again admitted, that his account of the secondary causes which contributed to the progress and establishment of Christianity leaves the question as to the natural or supernatural origin of Christianity practically untouched. This is all very well, but in that case, how about the century of abuse which has been showered upon the historian? Some posthumous apology would seem to be called for. Physically, Gibbon was as small as Johnson was large, but there was a curious affinity in their bodily ailments. Johnson, as a youth, was ulcerated and tortured by the king's evil, in spite of the royal touch. Gibbon gives us a concise, but lurid account of his own boyhood. Was successively afflicted by lethargies and fevers, by opposite tendencies to a consumptive and dropsical habit, by a contraction of my nerves, a fistula in my eye, and the bite of a dog, most vehemently suspected of madness. Every practitioner was called to my aid, the fees of the doctors were swelled by the bills of the apothecaries and surgeons. There was a time when I swallowed more physic than food, and my body is still marked by the indelible scars of lancets, issues, and caustics. Such is his melancholy report. The fact is that the England of that day seems to have been very full of that hereditary form of chronic ill health which we call by the general name of struma. How far the hard-drinking habits in vogue for a century or so before had anything to do with it, I cannot say, nor can I trace a connection between struma and learning, but one has only to compare this account of Gibbon with Johnson's nervous twitches, his scarred face and his St. Vitus's dance, to realize that these, the two most solid English writers of their generation, were each heir to the same gruesome inheritance. I wonder if there is any picture extant of Gibbon in the character of subaltern in the South Hampshire militia? With his small frame, his huge head, his round, chubby face, and the pretentious uniform, he must have looked a most extraordinary figure. Never was there so round a peg in a square hole. His father, a man of a very different type, held a commission, and this led to poor Gibbon becoming a soldier in spite of himself. War had broken out, the regiment was mustered, and the unfortunate student, to his own utter dismay, was kept under arms until the conclusion of hostilities. For 3 years he was divorced from his books, and loudly and bitterly did he resent it. The South Hampshire militia never saw the enemy, which is perhaps as well for them. Even Gibbon himself pokes fun at them. But after 3 years under canvas it is probable that his men had more cause to smile at their bookworm captain than he had his men. His hand closed much more readily on a pen handle than on a sword hilt. In his lament, one of the items is that his colonel's example encouraged the daily practice of hard, and even excessive drinking, which gave him the gout. The loss of so many busy and idle hours were not compensated for by any elegant pleasure, says he, and my temper was insensibly soured by the society of rustic officers, who were alike deficient in the knowledge of scholars and the manners of gentlemen. The picture of Gibbon flushed with wine at the mess table, with these hard-drinking squires around him, must certainly have been a curious one. He admits, however, that he found consolations as well as hardships in his spell of soldiering. It made him an Englishman once more, it improved his health, it changed the current of his thoughts. It was even useful to him as an historian. In a celebrated and characteristic sentence, he says, "The discipline and evolutions of a modern battalion gave me a clearer notion of the phalanx and the legions, and the captain of the Hampshire Grenadiers has not been useless to the historian of the Roman Empire." If we don't know all about Gibbon, it is not his fault, for he wrote no fewer than 6 accounts of his own career, each differing from the other, and all equally bad. A man must have more heart and soul than Gibbon to write a good autobiography. It is the most difficult of all human compositions, calling for a mixture of tact, discretion, and frankness which make an almost impossible blend. Gibbon, in spite of his foreign education, was a very typical Englishman in many ways, with the reticence, self-respect, and self-consciousness of the race. No British autobiography has ever been frank, and consequently no British autobiography has ever been good. Trollope's, perhaps, is as good as any that I know, but of all forms of literature it is the one least adapted to the national genius. You could not imagine a British Rousseau, still less a British Benvenuto Cellini. In one way it is to the credit of the race that it should be so. If we do as much evil as our neighbors, we at least have grace enough to be ashamed of it and to suppress its publication. There on the left of Gibbon is my fine edition, Lord Braybrooke's, of Peepy's Diary. That is, in truth, the greatest autobiography in our language, and yet it was not deliberately written as such. When Mr. Peepys jotted down from day to day every quaint or mean thought which came into his head, he would have been very much surprised had anyone told him that he was doing a work quite unique in our literature. Yet his involuntary autobiography, compiled for some obscure reason or for private reference, but certainly never meant for publication, is as much the first in that line of literature as Boswell's book among biographies or Gibbon's among histories. As a race, we are too afraid of giving ourselves away ever to produce a good autobiography. We resent the charge of national hypocrisy, and yet of all nations we are the least frank as to our own emotions, especially on certain sides of them. Those affairs of the heart, for example, which are such an index to a man's character, and so profoundly modify his life, what space do they fill in any man's autobiography? Perhaps in Gibbon's case the omission matters little, for, save in the instance of his well-controlled passion for the future Madame Necker, his heart was never an organ which gave him much trouble. The fact is that, when the British author tells his own story, he tries to make himself respectable, and the more respectable a man is, the less interesting does he become. Rousseau may prove himself a maudlin degenerate. Selinai may stand self-convicted as an amorous ruffian. If they are not respectable, they are thoroughly human and interesting all the same. The wonderful thing about Mr. Peepys is that a man should succeed in making himself seem so insignificant, when really he must have been a man of considerable character and attainments. Who would guess it who read all these trivial comments, these catalogues of what he had for dinner, these in and domestic confidences, all the more interesting for their inanity? The effect left upon the mind is of some grotesque character in a play, fussy, self-conscious, blustering with women, timid with men, dress-proud, purse-proud, trimming in politics and in religion, a garrulous gossip immersed always in trifles. And yet, though this was the day-by-day man, the year-by-year man was a very different person, a devoted civil servant, an eloquent orator, an excellent writer, a capable musician, and a ripe scholar who accumulated 3,000 volumes, a large private library in those days, and had the public spirit to leave them all to his university. You can forgive old Peepys a good deal of his philandering when you remember that he was the only official of the Navy Office who stuck to his post during the worst days of the plague. He may have been, indeed, he assuredly was, a coward, but the coward who has sense of duty enough to overcome his cowardice is the most truly brave of mankind. But the one amazing thing which will never be explained about Peepys is what on earth induced him to go to the incredible labor of writing down in shorthand cipher not only all the trivialities of his life, but even his own very gross delinquencies which any other man would have been only too glad to forget. The diary was kept for about 10 years, and was abandoned because the strain upon his eyes of the crabbed shorth and was helping to destroy his sight. I suppose that he became so familiar with it that he wrote it and read it as easily as he did ordinary script. But even so, it was a huge labor to compile these books of strange manuscript. was in an effort to leave some memorial of his own existence, to single him out from all the countless sons of men? In such a case he would assuredly have left directions in somebody's care with a reference to it in the deed by which he bequeathed his library to Cambridge. In that way he could have ensured having his diary read at any date he chose to name after his death. But no allusion to it was left, and if it had not been for the ingenuity and perseverance of a single scholar, the moldy volumes would still lie unread in some top shelf of the Papisian library. Publicity, then, was not his object. What could it have been? The only alternative is reference and self-information. You will observe in his character a curious vein of method and order, by which he loved to be forever estimating his exact wealth, cataloging his books, or scheduling his possessions. It is conceivable that this systematic recording of his deeds, even of his misdeeds, was in some sort analogous, sprung from a morbid tidiness of mind. It may be a weak explanation, but it is difficult to advance another one. One minor point which must strike the reader of Pepys is how musical a nation the English of that day appear to have been. Everyone seems to have had command of some instrument, many of several. Part singing was common. There is not much of Charles II's days which we need envy, but there, at least, they seem to have had the advantage of us. It was real music too, music of dignity and tenderness, with words which were worthy of such treatment. This cult may have been the last remains of those medieval pre-Reformation days, when the English church choirs were, as I have read somewhere, the most famous in Europe. A strange thing this for a land which in the whole of last century has produced no single master of the first rank. What national change is it which has driven music from the land? Has life become so serious that song has passed out of it? In southern climes one hears poor folk sing for pure lightness of heart. In England, alas, the sound of a poor man's voice raised in song means only too surely that he is drunk. And yet it is consoling to know that the germ of the old powers is always there ready to sprout forth, if they be nourished and cultivated. If our cathedral choirs were the best in the old Catholic days, it is equally true, I believe, that our orchestral associations are now the best in Europe. So, at least, the German papers said on the occasion of the recent visit of a North of England choir. But one cannot read Pepys without knowing that the general musical habit is much less cultivated now than of old. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.